Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Sustainable Finance Podcast. My name is Paul Ellis, and I'm your host for these programs about developments in this fast-growing industry. My podcast guest today leads the research and advisory team at Jefferies in their energy transition and sustainable business efforts. From 2022 through 2024, Anikat Shah and his team at Jefferies, a leading global financial services firm, have been ranked number one in the Institutional Investor Survey and Asia Money Brokers Poll for sustainability research in the U.S., Europe, Japan, and Australia. Anikat is passionate about advancing the global agenda on sustainability and on human rights. He serves on the board of directors of the UN Sustainable Development Solutions Network and teaches as an assistant adjunct professor at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs. Hello, Anikat, and welcome to the Sustainable Finance Podcast.
Thank you so much, Paul. It's such a great pleasure and privilege for me to be with you, and I look forward to our discussion.
Yes, you know, we've been trying to get this set up for quite a while, and I'm really glad that we're arriving at the point where we're going to be discussing issues today. And one of the first things that I wanted to talk about is something that you mentioned when I heard you speak at on a webinar not too long ago, and that is that the incredible importance of actually being physically on the ground in markets and in economies where you are assessing analytical issues, especially in relation to sustainable investing. Could you tell our followers a little bit about the way you do that?
Sure, with pleasure. You know, when I was earlier in my career, I came across a wonderful quote from John le Carré, the British author of spy novels, and he said, a desk is a dangerous place from which to understand the world. And I've been thinking about that quote ever since. You know, obviously there's a lot that one can learn from listening to podcasts and reading books and so on and so forth. But in my life, nothing comes even close to the knowledge that one develops by being in country, being in a region, talking to the people, talking to the taxi drivers, walking through the factories, going to the villages. That's when, it kickstarts a part of your brain that doesn't get even kickstarted when you are behind a desk. And so I've always found it very, very helpful and meaningful and frankly fun to get on a plane and go somewhere, or to get on a bus and go somewhere in my own city. It doesn't mean you have to go long and far, but just to see things with your own eyes and try to make sense of it on your own. And so, yes, I tell every professional, client, student, my three-year-old child that I'm going and seeing places and engaging with places firsthand is absolutely essential. And Paul, it's especially essential when you're trying to understand sustainability and sustainable development. And I'll tell you why. Sustainable development is a complex problem. It is not a linear problem. In other words, there are many connected parts, and you only understand the whole story when you can put all those parts together. And to put all the parts together, you have to feel and see all the parts. You have to talk to the taxi driver to understand the politics, and you have to talk to the local businesses to understand the business and finance, and you have to go into the villages to understand the labor dimension, and you have to put all of those pieces together, which you can only do when you're in person.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that introduction to your remarks today. And I want to follow on with a specific question about the new presidential administration's efforts related to climate adaptation, because another presentation that I, or an interview that I heard with you fairly recently, was about adaptation and resilience as important parts of sustainable investment for people to focus on as investors now. And let us talk a little bit here about what President Trump's efforts around climate adaptation are or aren't.
Sure. Yeah, with pleasure. I'm glad that we're focusing the discussion on climate adaptation and resilience, Paul. I've been trying for the last 5 years to get more investors to engage with this topic. You know, very simply put, I've always said there are three ways that an investor can invest in the climate theme. There's mitigation, there's adaptation, and there's carbon removal. All three of them are important, but the investment community spends 99% of its time on mitigation, 0.9% of its time on adaptation, and 0.1% of its time on removal. And I'm trying to change that ratio a little bit. The reality is that the world is not transitioning away from fossil fuels fast enough to meet our Paris climate goals. And as a result, unfortunately, we as a global economy are going to have to confront, deal, adapt, and become resilient to a growing number of physical climate risks that we have brought upon ourselves due to anthropogenic climate change. And climate adaptation is basically a catch-all phrase to encompass all of the different ways that society is going to have to adapt. For example, we're going to have to figure out how to deal with more heat. Extreme heat is going to be a real challenge. It already is in many parts of the world, South Asia, Middle East, Southeast Asia. There will be entire parts of those countries and regions that will become uninhabitable because of extreme heat. And we're going to have to figure out ways to cool large areas very efficiently in order to deal with extreme heat. Water is another physical climate risk. In some parts of the world, there are huge water droughts. That's going to require water desalination. In other parts of the world, there's going to be more and more floods, and that's going to require flood management systems. And the good news for investors is that there are wonderful companies that are building solutions to all of these problems, and that they are investable, and they've made a lot of money over the last few years, because in some ways, their rise and their need is inevitable. So with that as a backdrop, the question is about President Trump and what is his strategy around adaptation versus mitigation versus removal. Well, first things first is that it's not clear as of today if there's any strategy on climate change, period. So far from the first 4 months of the Trump administration, it seems like most attention is elsewhere. It's on tariffs, it's on tax cuts, it's on expanding the role of executive power. Climate change is not a high priority for this administration. And if it were to be a priority, then anything we can glean so far is to, if anything, slow down efforts on mitigation. So even just a few days ago, we were starting to get a sense of what the Inflation Reduction Act might look like going forward. And it's not very good news for the deployment of renewables and the deployment of energy efficiency. Okay, so what we know so far is that climate change is not a high priority for President Trump. And if anything, mitigation is going to be deprioritized. I do believe that one way the Republican Party may move forward on climate change is through the adaptation lens. And I have reason to believe that because you are seeing more and more Republicans talk about adaptation very openly. For example, you heard Governor DeSantis talk about this during his campaign that, you know, basically that the state of Florida is adapting to climate change and will continue to do so. You've seen a prominent Republican politicians like Vivek Ramaswamy make the same argument that we will just adapt to climate change as opposed to go through the long and arduous efforts of trying to mitigate and move to a low carbon future. The reality is you need to do both. We need to both mitigate and adapt. But I have a sense that if anything, we're going to see the Trump administration move towards adaptation. Now, what would that look like? That's an interesting question. I think we're going to spend a lot of time today talking about that. But I think there are a few core sectors that we should all focus on. Again, I already mentioned cooling. I think that's very important. Water and water management, I mentioned that. That's very important. Grid resilience is super important because we have a huge grid challenge in this country. Not only do we need more grids, but the grid system that we have in place needs to become resilient to extreme weather events. So I think that's a third area that we're focused on. And number four is agriculture. And President Trump, a lot of his voting base is, of course, rural America. And rural America is being impacted by a lot of these physical climate risks. And I think there are lots of ways that we can look at climate adaptation themes in that space. So that's what I'm focused on. So far, not much from President Trump on the adaptation story, but I hope Republicans do more, and we're seeing early glimpses of it so far.
You know, Anika, one of the things that I have been hearing in the last couple of weeks, at least, is talk around infrastructure building and adaptation from that perspective. Now, we all know that the IRA Act allocated tremendous tax benefits and funding across red and blue states, actually primarily red states. So permitting reform is a big topic for both Republicans and Democrats at this point in time. And we've seen some executive orders that could leave one to believe that Trump is serious about speeding up infrastructure build, whether it's in farming communities or in the cities or however you're going to reduce the carbon pollution. Do you think this is real? And how would it impact climate adaptation and resilience-related investment strategies?
That's a great question, Paul. And I think you hit the nail on the head. One of the core underlying economic philosophies of President Trump and this administration is the reindustrialization of America. We saw that, of course, with the trade tariffs that President Trump has put into place. We are seeing other forms of industrial policy coming up all over the place. And the underlying goal of this is to do more manufacturing and more industrial development here in the U.S. Now, we can argue whether the way President Trump is going about it is correct or not, but that is very clearly a goal. In order to do that, that will require more infrastructure. That will require more power. That will require more grids. That will require more factories. That will require more manufacturing sites. And all of that requires a complete overhaul of how we permit new infrastructure projects. Because right now, the single biggest bottleneck to get new infrastructure projects built is our permitting system. It takes years and years and years to build anything in the U.S. And that's largely because you have to go through the long and arduous process of getting federal, state, and local permits. You have to get environmental assessments done. Many of these environmental assessments take 6, 7, 8, 10, 11 years to happen. And by the time you get those permits, project developers move on and the projects don't go anywhere. Without solving permitting, Paul, you get to the problem that we've had over the last 3 years, which is even though President Biden put into place some very significant tax credits, you mentioned the Inflation Reduction Act, we could have talked about the CHIPS Act, we could have talked about the bipartisan infrastructure law. Despite all of that, infrastructure spend as a percentage of GDP continued to decrease under President Biden because there wasn't a whole of government re-examination, and there wasn't an examination of what are the actual constraints to getting more things built. So with that as backdrop, we are seeing some executive orders already being put into place by President Trump that have identified this permitting constraint on new infrastructure build. President Trump, for example, created something called a National Investment Accelerator, which is a new institution inside the Department of Commerce that will accelerate and fast track any large infrastructure investment over $1 billion. He's put out other executive orders that say that for other large infrastructure projects, a lot of the NEPA, which is the National Environmental Policy Act, many of the NEPA requirements would be overridden. All of these things could be positive. I mean, they could actually help us build more things more quickly in the United States. This, Paul, you may know of a book that's getting a lot of attention in Democratic circles right now called Abundance by Ezra Klein. And he's making sort of the same argument that unless we solve some of these permitting challenges, we will not see the kind of reindustrialization and manufacturing and economic boom that both Democrats and Republicans want. So all of this is to say that there are early glimpses of what I think are positive developments. Now the question begs itself, can President Trump actually execute on this, and can the country execute on this? And for that, we will see.
Okay, so now we have a president who's focusing at the moment a lot of his time and effort on trade policy and how that's going to affect whether it's fossil fuel energy development or clean energy infrastructure development. At the moment, it's not clear it's pretty clear where he wants to emphasize, but it's also pretty clear that there's been a tremendous buildup in clean energy infrastructure over the last decade or so. So let me just pick one example and ask you to take a look at that particular infrastructure build-out, and that is grid battery industries and how that is going to either help or slow down the build-out of energy grids across the country over the next few years anyway. So it's been growing very fast over the last few years, and will it continue?
Paul, the bottom line about trade tariffs and decarbonization is the following. We can either fight a global trade war or we can decarbonize quickly, but you can't do both. In other words, anytime you put on tariffs, particularly on Chinese imports into the United States, you are slowing down the pace of decarbonization. That's the fundamental, immutable truth. The reality is that China is the world's leader in effectively every aspect of the energy transition. Solar, wind, batteries, this is your storage question, nuclear, electric vehicles, critical minerals. That country owns the entire supply chain of these industries, effectively 70 to 80%. They have the lowest cost products in these areas. And if the U.S. wanted to decarbonize quickly, we would not have tariffs on their goods coming into the U.S., particularly in these areas. We would, for example, all be driving BYD cars right now at $15,000 a pop, cars that now can charge in 5 minutes. I was in a BYD in Singapore just 3 weeks ago. It's a remarkable vehicle. It costs a fraction of what a U.S. car costs. But what we decided as a country is that we rather protect local industry and local manufacturing rather than decarbonize. And that's a decision, frankly, that we've been making on both sides of the aisle. I'm a free trade guy. I actually think that international trade is a good thing. I think comparative advantage is real. I think if China can make certain goods cheaper and more efficiently than we can, that we should just import from them. And that's particularly important for storage and batteries and all of this. Yes, do we have a storage industry in the U.S.? Sure. But it's a tiny fraction compared to what's happening in China. And so all of this is to say that, yes, storage will increase, storage will improve. We're seeing more and more batteries on the grid in Texas, in California. That will continue to happen. But we could happen much more quickly if we allowed ourselves to not be in this trade conflict with China and import their goods. And I think that's just a fundamental truth of the reality.
Okay, now, I've been hearing from other business leaders, I listen to other podcasts, and I've been hearing people say, people who are in contact with the president, for example, around these issues, about the about how they are concerned about the declining investment in climate research, just the science of it, if nothing else, by the U.S. government, and in particular on climate change adaptation issues, as you articulated a few minutes ago. What's going on there that may or may not shift in the other direction within the next few years while Trump is still in office?
Yeah, look, there's it's sort of undeniable now that President Trump is gutting agencies inside the U.S. federal government. And one of the areas where we're seeing significant reduction in both funding and resources is something called NOAA, which is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Really the most advanced agency or department inside the U.S. government that was giving us all of the data, us meaning, you know, researchers and the public at large, all of the data that we needed to understand the changes in physical climate and physical climate risk. It was the NOAA models that we were all using to understand how weather patterns were changing and so on and so forth. And these, then NOAA is just one example, but there are several others like this, has seen a significant departure of their key staff, seen a significant already shutting down of programs. And this is a real challenge. Now, the question is, what will happen to that work? And are there other companies or governments that can pick it up? The good news is that even if the U.S. is backtracking on climate change, I am very confident that the rest of the world won't. And so it's you know, too bad in a way for the U.S. because we, for the next little while, may just not participate in one of the most significant economic changes of the global economy for the next 50 years. And the rest of the world will most likely just accelerate ahead. But to do that, you need data. And I think we're going to see much more limited climate adaptation. In other words, physical climate data coming from the U.S. government going forward.
All right. Well, that's not good news, but in anticipation of this continued uncertainty at the moment regarding U.S. clean energy transition, and more data and science coming out of our government and our scientific academic institutions, what should investors in the U.S. be focused on for the next couple of years, at least until the midterm elections?
Sure. I would say three main points. The first point I would make is that if you remain interested in investing in the climate theme, which I think we all should, because it is a multi-trillion-dollar multi-decadal shift that is going to change how we do everything in the world economy. I think you should be focused a lot more on opportunities on the mitigation side outside of US and Europe for the next 3 years. So over 2025 through 2028, if you were to allocate into this theme of climate mitigation, I'm going to come to adaptation for point number two, but just on mitigation, I think the best investment opportunities will be in China. I think they'll be in Japan. I think they're going to be in India. I think they're going to be in the Middle East. There are extraordinary companies in electric vehicles, for example, in China, like BYD. You have amazing companies in India that are deploying the largest solar projects in the world, like Adani. You have amazing companies in Japan, both public and private, that are supporting a $1 trillion energy transition program there known as the GX plan. You have companies in the Middle East that are driving huge adoption of water desalination through cheap solar like Aqua Power. And so on the mitigation side, I would say focus outside the U.S. because mitigation story in the U.S. is going to be quite difficult, and I think in Europe as well for the next little while. That's point number one. Point number two is on the adaptation story, what we've talked about today. I think there are going to be some very significant opportunities in US and Europe during this period of uncertainty. I'm very much excited about companies that I'm seeing in, like I've mentioned already, in the water space, companies in the cooling space, companies that are going to be supporting our farmers in the agriculture space. And all of this is going to happen in this theme of adaptation in the United States and Europe over the next 3 years, because frankly, we don't have a choice. Adaptation to increased physical climate risk is something that we're just going to have to do one way or the other. So that would be point number two, is if you're going to focus on investing in US and Europe, but let's just talk about the US, I would make it adaptation focused. And on adaptation, I would be focusing on at least these three themes, which are water, heat, and agriculture. And then a final thing I would just say in all of this is that I think more and more of our clients and your listeners need to open up pools of their capital and invest in private companies.
Yes, because absolutely. I didn't mean to jump on top of you there, but no. I feel so strongly about this, and I'm glad you're bringing it up.
Yeah, and it's, you know, Paulie, it could be 5% of your portfolio. It could be 2%. I'm not saying put all your money in early stage venture capital and you know, growth capital and all of this. But the reality is that this is a growth industry. It's still in its early stages, and the most exciting innovations are oftentimes in small disruptive companies that are outside the public markets. And there are wonderful private equity, venture capital, growth equity funds that are working in the climate adaptation space. You know, I spend a lot of time with a firm called the Lightsmith Group. They are a private equity, sort of a growth equity firm only focused on climate adaptation. And I think they're going to be more and more like them. And I would just suggest that we all look at those kinds of firms and consider allocating more capital to them. So that would be those would be my three very specific pieces of advice. On mitigation, focus outside US and Europe. On adaptation, focus on the US, particularly in these sectors that I mentioned, and then allocate more capital to the private markets. And I think you'll be able to find some great opportunities and commercialize this trend.
Great. Well, Anikad, thank you so much for your time today. I know how busy you are on a day-to-day basis. And when your assistant sent me your travel schedule to try and book this recording, I must admit it was difficult to find a day and time that wasn't already occupied by someone else's meeting or someone else or travel that you were doing. So keep up the good work. You and your team are doing a fantastic job. And what you've shared with our listeners today, I think, is so important to the future of all of this type of economic development here in the U.S. So where online, Anikad, can our followers go to learn more about sustainability and the energy transition strategies that you are pursuing at Jefferies? And how can they get in touch with you with questions about the issues that we have discussed in today's podcast episode?
Well, first of all, Paul, thank you very much for all that you do. You are doing a remarkable service to the financial and investment community and have been for a long, long time. So kudos to you and a thank you to you. For those who are listening who want to be in touch, best way to reach out is just to contact me directly. My email address is ashah14, that's A-S-H-A-H-1-4, at jefferies.com, J-E-F-F-E-R-I-E-S, jefferies.com. Just send me an email. We can get you on our distribution list of our research, and we can see what we can do together. So just please reach out.
Great. Well, thanks again very much. Anikad Shah, Managing Director and Global Head of Sustainability and Transition Strategy at Jefferies. Anikad, have a great day, and thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
And to our listeners, thanks for joining us for today's episode, and join me again next week. My name is Paul Ellis, and this is the Sustainable Finance Podcast.